Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I want you to feel free to interrupt. I love the challenge. I love the thinker, the practitioner who is wrestling with how do you do discipleship. There are two broad questions that I've thought about for many, many years now. And the first one was, why did God love me and give his son to die for me? And the second one is, how did Jesus do it? How did he take 12 untrained, uneducated men and through them turn the world upside down and have the gospel spread throughout the whole world? But before we get into this, I also want to say how honored I am, and I sincerely mean that I know Mark Sterling. Here's a man who could have given himself to practice medicine the rest of his life, but he goes on from there after an extensive education and practice to get his PhD. But what I've noticed about him the most, and he was in Atlanta this past year. We had a wonderful time together over a meal with two other people in Atlanta. And I'm so impressed with his heart for the Lord Jesus Christ, for his humility with all of his background and his commitment to leave Scotland and come here also to engage in this incredibly important job of helping people learn what Christian disciple is and how to practice it. And the second person, I haven't spotted him yet, there he is, right next to him, Jay Eastman. I met him in the first ELF that I came to in Eger, Hungary, and immediately my heart was drawn to him and what he's doing in Berlin, and to see his passion for the lost, for discipleship. And I feel honored also to be here with Jay. So with that, let me tell you how I decided to approach today. You see no PowerPoint. In the past two times that I've been here, I've been loaded down with PowerPoint and decided this year I would just swing the pendulum to the other side and have none. And that may be an overreaction. But I'm wanting to look into your eyes. I'm wanting to look into your countries, into your ethnic groups, into your languages, into your hearts, and to find out what you really need. How can I be of best service to you? And this is not an American coming to you with all of our latest ideas. You're going to see me running from most of what I see in America. And if I don't surprise you with a few statements that I make about discipleship, then I think I would have failed. So what I'm going to do is to take a paragraph that was adapted from a paragraph that Mark Sterling wrote when he asked me through Amber Thomas of ELF to come once into this foundational discipleship network and to give me kind of some arrows. This is the direction we want to go. You should have it in your notebook, and I rarely do this, but I will read with just brief comment this opening paragraph, and then I will not go through these lecture notes one by one. Okay? And I think I see relief on everybody's face, because you probably see about 4 hours worth. So let me begin. The practice of biblical discipleship always demands that we consider the social, linguistic, geopolitical, economic, ecclesiastical, and spiritual context in which we are operating. In other words, discipleship, on the one hand, is very simple. Jesus says, follow me. On the other hand, I would say it's one of the most complex things that I ever do when I meet with men to disciple them on a weekly basis. How do we develop tools to effectively disciple the people whom God has given us without disregarding their uniqueness and need to be placed in or treated as part of a broader context? If there's anything that I resist, it is a cookie-cutter approach to any person or any group of people. To say that one size fits all is really not appropriate for the fact that we're made in the Imago Dei. We're made in the image of God, and every single person is created uniquely and wired in different ways with different giftedness, some left brain, some right brain, some with a calling to do this and some to do that. And if we don't have that set of eyes to see not only at a person but through a person, then we will tend to go to a bookstore, pull a book off the shelf, and then to say, I think everybody ought to study this book. I think everyone ought to do my curriculum. And so the first thing I want to say is that I don't think there is one or two curricula in the world that every Christian ought to go through. I think that there are thousands of curricula to go through in order to take us through the one curricula, which is the feast, and that's God's Word. Every other book is commentary on that book. And so my typical visual image is that the Bible is the feast on the table, and every other book, no matter how good and how scholarly, are crumbs on the table, crumbs on the floor under the table. And so I found in discipleship that many people focus more on books that are written about the Bible than the Bible itself. And so you're going to hear me speak about that. Without succumbing to various ready-made discipleship programs, how can we creatively and imaginatively design effective and life transformational tools to build mature believers who will follow Christ without reservation? No holds barred, full surrender, Paul's statement to the Corinthians, I die daily. During this session, I'm going to be sharing how I've developed tools in my own context to help him disciple people, as well as discussing how you might do the same in your own context. I am grateful, and I think that this might be helpful to you, that this is not the just third time I've been to a various country. I've been to 30 countries, and by God's grace, I've interacted in homes and in lecture halls and different places to really wrestle with some of the hardest groups. My first trip to Poland years ago, to Warsaw, and it's the first time that I heard the Polish men, it was all men, about 25 of them, who told Polish jokes on themselves, and it was great. I was teaching on Jesus telling the disciples to count the cost, and Jesus, of course, gives us two examples. Who would go out and build a tower and then realize they didn't have enough money to build it? And one of the guys said, oh, Polish builders. And really? And then I thought, well, I'm going to move on. So I said, you know, what general with 1,000 men would go out against one with 3,000? And the guy said, a Polish general. So I'm saying, wow, I always thought it was inappropriate to tell Polish jokes and they're telling them on themselves. So finally I said, well, let's just move on from that text. But that kind of richness coming right after communism fell, and then one of the questions came, in America you have so much curricula that you can use, we have nothing. And I froze for a moment, and then I said back to that man, through translation, but don't you have the Bible in Polish? Yes. Well, there's your curriculum. And I think that we have been almost brainwashed to think that we have to have some kind of special curriculum called discipleship curriculum that may be different from some other curricula in order to get the job done. And what I tend to do is go all the way back to the first century, and there were certainly no printing presses, no bookstores. And as you know, the book of Galatians was a cyclical that was being circulated around to the churches of Galatia. And people were hungry to read those letters and those gospels. So let's not be spoiled, but let's say, what's the best way that we can, as men and women, get involved in discipleship? I am going to start with an illustration, and then we're going to begin that interaction. We've talked about context, but I want you to think about something that probably Mark and Jay have already brought to you. I may bring it in a little bit different way. So you have someone standing before you, and I don't mean literally, but someone that you're going to be investing in, and that can represent any number of people. It could be a group, it could be two groups, but just one person right now. You're looking at that person, and the very fact that you're wanting to disciple that person or mentor that person, or may we also use the more popular term that's now coming to play, at least in America, spiritual formation. We're thinking about this person being spiritually formed into the image of Christ following Colossians chapter 1. So they ask us, or we ask them, and now we're engaged in some kind of covenant together with the goal being that this person receive from us what has been placed inside of us. And somehow that connection has been made, and now there's some kind of formal or semi-formal commitment to work together over some period of time in order that they might grow. So the question that I want to ask you first is, do you know where you're going to take them? Because there are people who have taken people to wrong places. If you've ever watched world news going all the way back to Jim Jones in French Guiana, then you know that he took almost 1,000 people to their deaths in drinking poison Kool-Aid. Not every leader is a wise and good leader. There are evil leaders. And some of you have come out of countries where you have experienced the authority of an unwise and an evil leader. So where do you want to take them? And I'm going to draw on the flip chart here just for a moment. An illustration that I've been using for a number of years since I went to a chocolate factory in our northern state of Pennsylvania. Some of you have seen this piece of candy, some of you have not. But it's just called a Kiss. And the name of this Kiss is a Hershey Kiss, named after Milton Hershey, who founded the company in the late 1800s. This particular piece of candy has been around since 1901. So it's 112 years old now. It's a little teardrop-shaped piece of chocolate wrapped in a foil. It used to be only silver, and now at Christmas, it's Christmas colors, and at Easter, it's Easter colors, etc. Being a math major at the university, and I've always loved logic and math, after I toured the Hershey Chocolate Factory and bought a biography of Milton Hershey, and I love biography, began to read about his life and how he ultimately produced this, I came up with this very simple illustration, but it's always made the point, it's always connected with people in whatever country I've been in, even if they don't know personally the Hershey Kiss. We put that on the right side because it's a product, and it has to be made, it has to be produced. And before anyone can make it, the imagination has to be engaged so that someone has visualized it first in the mind and then produced in reality. If we can't see it in the mind, it cannot be invented. It cannot be produced. And the same thing with discipleship. If you're just looking at that person and your primary focus is on, I want to take them through this curriculum, then you've got it all upside down. You want to look at them and ask the question, what is a profile of a mature disciple? What does he or she look like? And if you don't know what that person should look like, if you can't read the New Testament and to see the attributes inside of a disciple, the skills that they need to develop, the knowledge base that they need in order to live life to the fullest and in service to their master, then all you're doing is spending time with someone, and your greatest claim to fame is that you finished the curriculum. I can't tell you how many times, seriously, that I've heard that. Well, we finished that study. Did you ever hear this from Charles Spurgeon, the great preacher in London, Metropolitan Tabernacle? He asked someone one day about reading the Bible, and this man actually boasted a bit about having gone through the Bible every year for a number of years. And Spurgeon said, that's not the point. Has the Bible been through you? And that's what we're really looking for, is life transformation. We're looking to see whether a man in his home really is loving his wife like Christ loved the church. We really are asking the question, is he or she slow to anger? Are they really sharing their life story, their testimony, and the gospel with lost people? Do they really have a heart for the whole world? And is it a growing heart for the nations, not just for their locale? Do they really pray, or do they just talk about prayer? So we put that on the right side of the equation, and then in order to produce this, we go back here to the left side, and of course, we need raw materials. And in order to make this simple, because this is not a formula for making chocolate, but we do know that Hershey needed the cocoa from the cocoa bean, and we also know that he needed sugar. We also know that he needed milk, some preservatives, because from the very beginning he wanted to export the chocolate to the world. We know that he needed a little piece of foil, like tin foil, to wrap around it, and a little tag that just says Hershey coming out the top. Those are the raw materials. When you have a disciple, someone that has come to you, or again, you've gone to them to say, would you come with me? Or they've said, would you please mentor me? And it can operate in both ways, by the way. Then the first thing you have to establish is, who are they? That takes time. Did you know that there's a 1-year gap between two verses in Mark chapter 1? Stefan was speaking on this the other night, and it's the first chapter in A.B. Bruce's great work, The Training of the Twelve, and it's the call of the first five disciples. And it looks like Jesus walks up to these men, James and John and Andrew and Peter, fishing on the lake, and saying, drop your nets and follow me. That was a full 14 months after John the Baptist said, there's the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. At the beginning of Jesus' ministry with them, he was just associating with them to get to know them. And then they would go back to their fishing, then come with him again, and then back. And so it was only after that time in Mark 3 that Jesus goes up to the mountain to pray. And then the next day, he chooses 12 to be with him on a permanent basis. And that's when they leave their father, Zebedee, and their work, and they then, from that point on, go with Jesus full time. So we need to ask the question, who is that person in front of me? What have they experienced in life? We need to get to know their story. And that story can only be told by them. And that means we also have to be very good listeners. We have to be perceptive. What has happened in their lives? How were they raised? What kind of father? What kind of mother? What was their experience educationally? Do they have particular addictions? What's going on inside of them. That's who you've been given. So at any point when your life intersects in time and space with that individual, then at that moment when you meet them, whether it's as a teenager at 16, or whether it's someone in their mid-20s in their first career experience, or someone in their 30s that now have children and marriage and so forth, or whether it's someone in their 60s, you have to find out where they are and what they need from that point on. The last part of this before we move into discussion is that, and I'm a terrible artist, it's so interesting. My son is a portrait artist, and if he were here, he could draw your face and it would be spot on within 30 minutes. And I can't draw a factory. But anyway, you're going to have to pretend and use your imagination. That's smoke coming out of chimneys. Okay. We have a great school in Atlanta called Georgia Tech. Georgia Institute of Technology. That's not the greatest one in our nation. It's in Boston, MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But Georgia Tech ranks in the top 10 every year. And there's a curriculum that people go through that takes 5 years, and it's called industrial engineering. And it's how do you put together a factory, put the machines in the right place, all the technology, in order that the materials go through this factory, and on the other side of it, you get the product that you've designed. If you convert this factory, we've already said that the raw material is a person that you've been given by the Lord when your life intersects with his or hers, but we convert this factory actually into a church. And the church not being a building, but the communion of God's people. After they've been in corporate discipleship as well as personal, individual discipleship, group discipleship, the question is, what do they look like? And you know that some people have been in the church for years and years, chronologically in time. It could be for 20 years, and it seems that they remain unchanged. So the same that you knew them, and you don't see any different passion for the Lord, you don't see any growth in very many areas. They're just there, they're in, but not much more than that. Also, you have people that have their favorite passages, and they never go beyond to study the book of Ecclesiastes, or Micah, or Nahum, or prophecy. The book of Revelation, eschatology, the Trinity, so many things like that. So that John Stott, in the first International Congress on Discipleship, made this statement that the greatest problem in the Church of Jesus Christ today is its superficiality. Harold Bloom at Harvard University, literary critic and scholar, said the same thing in a book that he wrote in our country, called The Dumbing Down of American Education. And now because of technology and everyone wants to Google and go on their computers and iPhones and the like, information can be readily available, but it doesn't mean that they have it. I'm going to begin to wrap up this so we can interact with a final story. I was discipling 5 young men. And I did for 5 years, and their ages, 28 to 32, all married but one. Now all of them are married, and only a couple of them at that time had kids, and now most of them do, young children. And so over the 5-year period, they're asking me questions. We're interacting 6:30 to 9 o'clock every Friday morning in my home. And so as we're moving along, we're getting more and more into questions that non-Christians are asking because they're sharing their faith. And they're saying, John, would you meet with so-and-so and so-and-so? And I said, look, the reason we're here is because I'm training you to be able to answer those kinds of questions and learn apologetics. And one guy spoke up unabashedly, unashamedly, and just said, no, that's why we have you. If we run into a question, we're just going to call you. And I said, well, then I'm not going to answer the phone. And my own daughter had, one of my own daughters had said that, Dad, don't ever die because I need you. When I run into people that I'm sharing Christ with, I want them to call you. But what Jesus did was impartation. He's imparting not just his life, but knowledge and skills for ministry so that they can do ministry alone with support along the way and guidance and wisdom in that. So that's the model that I would like for us to start with now. And I'd like to ask who has the first comment or question about this. How long do you disciple someone? I would imagine that everyone in here could name a curriculum that lasts 6 months. Someone else could say, well, this curriculum lasts 2 years. This one lasts 3 years. This one lasts four. There's some that last longer. The longest I've ever discipled a man is 17 years because he wasn't ready to be cast out. But now he's fruitful and has been every year since that time. If you knew his past story of brokenness and hurt and pain and lack of vulnerability and lack of confidence, you would know why I spent that long with him. But there is a launching point, just like today in America and probably in your countries too. And in our country, it's not because the students who graduated from college want to, as the necessity is in other countries, but because there are no jobs for these young people coming even out of law school and so forth, they're moving back in with their parents. And they consider that to be abnormal. They don't want to be back, but out of financial necessity and student loans and debt, they're coming back in. And so typically, in the just middle-class American family, this is what you would think. Birth, all the way through childhood, adolescence, 17, 18, right in there, 19 maybe, they're off to college or off to a trade school. And that's the last time they would be home. So there's a launching period. And that doesn't mean that the parents have put everything into their lives that they wanted to. But here's a phrase that I've loved since I heard it in Fort Lauderdale years ago. Those 18-year-olds are brought to functional maturity. Don't you have this concept of education that you went there not to learn everything in the world in 4 years or 3 years of seminary or whatever course of study you have gone to in your life, not even advanced degrees, that it just prepares you to go on from there. It teaches you how to study, how to gain knowledge and access so that growth is a lifelong experience. Personally, I've worked through some thoughts of what I want this person to look like. And so I have 4 years of standard, take them through curricula, and then they know they're going to be launched. They can appeal for a fifth year, and every group does. And typically I'll say, okay. And we go a fifth year to put some more things into their lives. After that, it's not that I disappear or they do. Just before I came here, I was driving to the airport. My wife was taking me to the airport in Atlanta, and I get a call from a Delta pilot who's in New Orleans getting ready to captain his ship to fly to San Francisco. I finished discipling him 10 years ago, but he had another question for me. I'm still engaged, involved in his life. But now it's on an as-need basis and not the regular week-to-week-to-week discipleship. I was addressing only one side of the coin, and that is the person who says, oh, I would never do any preparation during the week. I don't really need that. I don't like to read, and so I just don't think I could get up that early in the morning, to come and everything about them says resistance. So that's the person I'm talking about. But the one I discipled for 17 years, he said to me, I don't read. By trade, he's a professional and excellent photographer, doing really professional photos for a lot of wealthy people. But he just didn't read, and he always joked with me, don't give me curriculum unless it has great pictures in it, all right? And so he wanted to grow Mark, and I had to say to him, stick with me and let's just begin with one chapter, not with the whole 5 years. And would you just read this one this week? He was also resistant at the beginning before he came to the group by saying, I've been hurt too much in my life. I will not open up. And so I met with him alone for that. And I said, the group is where you can receive healing. And I need you to trust me that I'm going to create a safe environment where you will be able to share. And he said, I promise you I won't. Well, the reality is over those 17 years, it took about 5 or 6 before he opened the door just a little bit. That's how wounded he had been. But it takes that discernment to look through. Is it really resistance, or has something happened? Or have you ever tried to disciple someone who has dyslexia or ADHD, if those are familiar terms to you, where they are not good readers and they're afraid that you might call on them to read something in a group, even as an adult, and they can't read? I've had that in my group, so I'm sensitive to that. Or they're afraid that they're going to be asked to pray out loud when they've never done that in their lives. So it's discerning that heart and then saying, this other side of the coin, let me help you. The willingness of the heart is the matter there, not what their capability is. And then there was a book I read some time ago by Mortimer Adler. It really is the best book in the world on how to read a book. And one of his principles in there is that we need to read upwards to a book that's too hard for us so that it pulls us up in our understanding, in our knowledge, in our growth. If everyone continues to read the dumbed-down material of the Christian faith, that explains a lot of why people are where they are. And there are people who know Jesus loves them and they know about the blood that Jesus shed on the cross. But if you put them in a corner and said, can you differentiate between expiation and propitiation and forgiveness and the language of the cross? They may not even have ever heard those words and know the meaning of them and the richness and the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I'm pulling them along, and what I will always be sure to do is never embarrass anyone in the group, but if their hearts are willing, I'll say, if you'll just come, then we'll help you get to a place where you love Christ, you're living and walking by grace through faith, and we're going to help you to learn how to minister out of the gifts and abilities and talents that God has given you. And so this man of 17 years, he said, I'm not an evangelist. I'll never disciple anyone. And I knew that he was not only a photographer, but a gourmet cook. Anyone who knew him would have rather gone to his home at invitation to have dinner than in any restaurant in Atlanta. Any. Hands down. Gourmet cook. Delicious. So I said to him, why don't you start using your home for hospitality? And instead of just inviting Christians, start inviting non-Christians. And he started doing that. And then he said, I'll never disciple anyone until after 15 years. I've been training him all that time. And his senior pastor came to him, totally shocked him, and he said, haven't you been in John's group for a long time? Yeah, 15 years. He said, well, the truth is, you know more about discipleship than me or any of the elders in our church. And we're asking you if you would disciple me and the elders for a full year. He was so stunned, he couldn't even speak. And the pastor just put a little bit of pressure, please, we really need this, and he did it. Here he is discipling his pastor and the elders in his church. And the next year, every one of those, after learning from him, had their own groups, and that church began to really grow in disciple making. How did I know to keep going back then? Now I know the end of the story. I'm repeating the question for the tape. I didn't know the end of the story. Just like the 11 apostles did not know the end of the story for Judas. Remember, they're all looking at Jesus saying, is it I? You know, who is it? They didn't know it wasn't them. And they did not, therefore, suspect Judas. So I can't know the ultimate end. There are some that I've discipled that I think have great promise, and I would have predicted with the insight that I was able to have, which is very limited, that they would be very fruitful and multiply. And some of those have walked away from the Lord. Thankfully, very few, but they have. They're the Judases. I know one man, it still breaks my heart. He's now in California. He divorced his wife. He left his children, and he abandoned the faith, and he had an affair. And let me tell you, there was a time in the first year when he took such copious notes of our first year that if I had died, I would have said he's the one to get all the notes, because he just wrote down everything. I mean, just pages and pages, and a hunger. On the other hand, let me quickly tell you the story of another man, a very good college athlete, and the reason I met him was because he had an affair, and his wife found out. And someone, a mutual friend, said, go see John. I'm going to really boil this down. Short story, there's a lot of things in between. Both of them come to see me. She's ready to divorce him. By God's grace, I lead them both to Christ. I tell him, you don't have a prayer unless you get in a discipleship group and begin to grow. He had only been in a church twice in his life, his Catholic church, and one was for a baptism and one was for a wedding. He didn't know the Bible. He didn't own a Bible. And he was very good looking, very athletic, and all the girls chased him. He could have anybody he wanted, it seemed. So, and this wasn't the first time. This is the third time he'd had an affair. And that all happened in the first year of his marriage. So you can see why she's saying, I'm not going down this road. So he comes to Christ. He gets in my group. I begin to disciple him. So he's now in the second year, the third year. Boy, he is growing. And his wife sees it, and I counsel them for 2 years in marriage counseling. Rebuild trust. He's doing great, growing their family. They have more children, and now it looks like God has just done a great work. But he keeps saying to the group, and he looks at me, and he's very funny. He's very successful, sharp personality, and he would just say, I think to dig me, no matter what you say, I'm never going to do what you do, John. And I looked back at him and I said, oh, yes, you are. And he would say, oh, no, I'm not. You'll see. And the other guys would point at him and say, you've got to. This isn't about John. Jesus is telling you to do that. And so then it would die down and nothing would happen for months. Well, it came toward the end of 5 years. And he had studied apologetics with me and the Christian life and spiritual gifts and all these things. And so it's coming toward May when we finish the group. And my heart's frankly sinking a little bit, saying, man, I've spent 5 years. Was it all wasted? And so we all talked about that. What are we going to do? And he said, I told you, I'm never going to do that. So we end the group. And I don't see him all summer long because we're not meeting back again in September. So I get a call from him in early August. And he said, can I have 6:30 breakfast with you on a Friday morning? And I said, sure, let's get the calendars. We got this date. So I drove over about 45 minutes and he drove 45 to meet. And so when I got there, expecting just to see him, he had 5 guys there his age. He had led every single one of those men to Christ. And it was the start of a discipleship group that he led for 5 years. And so I've given you 2 illustrations of a guy that I thought will never reproduce who did, and one that I thought is going to take the world on, and he floundered and walked away from the Lord. So we can't predict. We just remain faithful along that journey. How long does it take to do anything? To make this Hershey Kiss, it takes a certain amount of time. By the way, the Lord called me into the ministry in the eighth grade, but I always wanted to be an architect or an engineer. So every chance I get, I go into buildings. I love beauty. And also I go into factories like this one. So I've gone into Coca-Cola factory. I've gone into the Coors beer factory in Denver, Colorado, et cetera. So when I went into the Coors beer factory to take that tour, it was a guided tour by a young lady. And so she's telling us about the hops and how long it takes to dry, and then it goes through this process and this and so forth. We come to the end, and she did something I thought was beautiful and very, I think, very helpful to me and this illustration. She stopped the group. There were about 20 of us. And she said, "Now I want you to think, have you been paying attention? How long does it take to make one can of beer?" And one person said, very foolishly, obviously had not been listening, 2 weeks? No. The right answer was 4 months to make one can of beer. So in discipleship, we can ask the question, how long is a piece of string? Well, it depends on what are you going to do with the string. So how long would it take you to teach someone the Navigator topical memory system? Okay, there's 60 verses in there, right? So that is measurable. If you want to put that inside someone, you have to determine how many verses a week and have them say it fore and aft and, you know, get the reference down. So you can follow the Navigator schedule, or you can come up with a schedule on your own. But there are 60 verses that I think are really important. That's measurable. How long would it take you to teach someone to have a basic presentation of the gospel? That's measurable. If it's the four spiritual laws, it's one thing. If it's Billy Graham's Peace with God, it's another. If it's Bill Hybels' presentation from Willow Creek, it's so many weeks. How long would it take you to help someone discover their spiritual gifts? That's measurable. You need to teach them about the filling and the baptism of the Holy Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit. And then before they know their gifts, they have to know what the gifts are. So at least 19 gifts of the Spirit, they have to have some working understanding. And then how long would it take you to help them to know themselves, to understand how God's made them and wired them, and then connect them with a particular ministry? You see the point. So if someone says, "Well, I only disciple for 1 year," then I can say, "Okay, tell me what you're going to produce in that person." And the answer is you can put certain things in 1 year. You can, if you extend it 6 months, put more in, etc. So it's not a matter of years. If we can get that out of our heads, it's what you're going to put in. And then the question is in the reverse, how long does it take to do that? And then to get it established in their lives, like the spiritual disciplines. If you've read any of Dallas Willard, The Spirit of the Disciplines, The Divine Conspiracy, you know that there are disciplines of engagement and disciplines of abstinence. How long does it take to teach someone to fast or to pray? How long does it take to put someone in a position where they're willing to experience solitude before the Lord? I actually met Dallas Willard at Oxford University in 1998 and heard him speak. And this is one of the things that he said that I'd never contemplated before. It was a measurement of how mature a believer is. And I never in all my life thought about it. And he said, put a person alone in solitude, and their level of maturity will be displayed by the amount of time it takes before they go stir crazy. Isn't that brilliant? the new believer only knows how to pray maybe 15 minutes, and then they say, what else do I say? But the navigators have taught people how to spend a day in prayer alone. But with my guys, I don't start with a day. I'll say start with 30 minutes and then work up and work out a situation with your wife where you spend a half a day alone and then work up to a day. And then finally, the most I've seen happen is a man that came to me one day at lunch and he said, I'm dating this girl. I don't know whether to marry her. I don't know what I should be doing in the church using my gifts. And I think I need to change my job. Can you help answer those questions? Over lunch? No. And I said, you need to get alone with the Lord. And he actually flew to Scotland. Someone gave him a cabin. And he went over and fasted and prayed for a week. And when he came back over a period of months, God answered all three of those questions. So discipleship doesn't always mean that we're giving answers to. It means we're creating environments where they move towards Christ to gain those answers. So back to your question. I think I'm getting all tangled up here. This is that creative paragraph that Mark wrote about taking your own situation and developing tools for your own ministry. God will put something in your heart as you seek Him in prayer about how much you're planning to put into those people's lives. Then, once you've created that, then you can begin the process of moving them through the curriculum. By the way, we haven't said this, but curricula really comes from a word that means race course. Think of the Olympics and an oval race course. So when you take a course of study at university, you're on that race course, and when you cross the finish line, you're receiving your diploma. So a curricula for discipleship means that you have a beginning and an ending, just like Jesus did in John 17, where he said, I have finished the work which you have given me to do. Well, you can't finish anything unless you have a plan by which you can measure that. So then, to answer your question now specifically, I lay out before them, if they come with me, what they will get in 5 years, plus things I don't know, but the other things that God will do in their lives during that time. And then I ask them for a one-year commitment. And then they re-up every year. Here's what's happened with that. At first they say 4 or 5 years. And then when they get to the fourth year, they say, I want to go further. So you want to make it so that they long for it rather than legalistically saying, this will make you a mature disciple. I don't want that in their minds. But what's happened, realistically and without hyperbole, we don't have people drop out of the groups unless they move away. And that's a factor that you would have to consider, you know, in that process. What I was trying to address was the model of Christ training the 12, and I wholeheartedly agree with that even Jesus had concentric circles of relationships, preaching to the masses, the John 6 Bread of Life sermon, the feeding of the 5,000, the 4,000, and other contexts where he's speaking to larger groups. And then everyone in here knows about the 12 and the 3 and the 1. And so there are various relationships. In the case of that man, there was no more contact because he didn't want it. But I'm doing the very same thing, meeting with people for different reasons. And it may be a one-time meeting, or it may be, as one man just recently asked me, would you meet with me over a series of weeks to work through this thing? Yes, but he's not a candidate to be in this intensive 4-year group. And so there's a fluidity to the life, or should be, to the life of every believer, where we're asking the Lord when we get up in the morning, who do you want me to be engaged with? Where do you want me to go? I'm yours. And then God will put you with people that need exactly what He's prepared you for. You'll have the knowledge, the experience, the compassion, whatever that need may be. And you'll see when you move away from it, not sometimes the whole story, but you'll see why God brought you into that person's life. And then there can be that transition, and hopefully would be, from the lesser commitment, like the early five disciples, who were just associated with Jesus more loosely until He brought them to be a part of that band of 12 for the apostleship. So I wholeheartedly agree with that. Now, this may shock you. This is not what I would call or you would call a discipleship group. But remember that everything in life is important. This is God's world as well as God's word. So my wife and I are in a literary group. And over the last 13 years, we've read 130 classic novels, fiction. We're reading Beowulf and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Charles Dickens, and it just goes on and on. And when we come out of that group, we meet once about every 6 weeks. We read about 9 books per year. And we are challenged to think Christianly, to critique the books and the authors and the like. We meet over coffee and dessert. And that's actually part of my discipleship, though we may never, you know, we're not going to have a devotional or anything to go with that to spiritualize it. We're saying this is part of what God is doing to speak into our lives. And then I'm shocked after all those years. I shouldn't have been. I'm saying that in a negative way. I was shocked when God began to put me with people who were readers. And it might be on an airplane. It might be somewhere at a restaurant. And all of a sudden, they're saying, well, have you ever read? Well, yeah. And what did you think about that? And then I go to movies and I go to theater. And my purpose in life is to read 50% non-believing works and 50% Christian works so that I'm always engaged in the culture and I can talk about where people are. And then what I see is God taking who I am. And sometimes I don't like that, but it's who I am. And God takes me and puts me with a person, and I need that experience. So that one illustration of what Mark is talking about, I go to meet a man for lunch to talk about an issue in his life that he wants help with. And so this woman, a young woman, 23 years old, is our waitress at the table. And she's from India, and I surmise that. I've been to India before on a couple of occasions. And so I'm always trying to interact with them and find that common ground. And so I ask her where she's from. Yes, she's from India. And then she goes to get water for us, and then she brings the food. And every time, I'm just trying to make a connection to her somewhere. So then toward the end of the meal, I haven't found one yet except to say I've been to India and we talked about this and that. And then my friend says, I'll be right back. I need to go to the restroom. So she comes over to the table, and maybe I've had 5 exchanges with her so far. And I said, may I ask you, are you a Hindu? And she said, no, I'm Jainist, from the Jainist religion. And I said, really? I went to a Jainist temple when I was in Mumbai and spent 3 hours there, and I saw how you buried your dead by hanging them out, and the birds of the air come and pick all the flesh off, and et cetera, et cetera. And she stood there. She was just totally shocked. She said, I've been in the States for about 10 years, and no one has ever, ever known about this. Where were you? And I told her about taking that tour and with one other man. And immediately there was a connection, and she said, I said, do you still embrace that? She said, no, my mom does and wants me to, but I think I see through it. Have you ever at all, the man I'm with is still in the bathroom, have you ever investigated this man, Jesus Christ? No, don't know anything about him. If I gave you or if I suggested books for you to read, would you read them? And she said, yes. And without a moment's notice, she pulls out her, you know, pad that she takes the order down on, and she said, go. And I said, okay, C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. And then I mentioned Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ. And she said, I'm going to read these books. So she was going into Emory Law School. Now I'm learning this girl is really smart. And she's going to finish up, and she tells me she wants to go into international law, and she's starting school in 2 weeks. She said, this next week is my last day. So the next week comes, and I'm in my office, and I realize that morning when I get with my secretary, I don't have an appointment today. And I said, go grab me those two books. Mere Christianity, I keep books in stock, and go get those two books. And that restaurant where I met that guy was 45 minutes away, but I said, Lord, would you bless this time? So I go to the restaurant, walk in, and I look at the front door, look around, and I don't see her. And I said, oh. And I knew that was her very last day. So they seat me, and I'm alone in a booth, and I brought something to read to, so I'm there reading. And then I look up, and I see she's in another section across the room. And I just prayed. I said, Lord, bring her to me. So for a while, 30 minutes or 40, she's over there. And then she walks right by me to go over this way for something. And I did this. And she recognized me, said, well, hi, how are you? She said, do you know what? And I put the books on the seat. She said, this is my last day. And as soon as my shift is over, I'm going over here to the library to get those two books that you asked me to read. And I said, you don't have to. Here they are. And I handed them to her, and it was like gold. And she said, thank you, thank you. Now, I've never seen her since. But that was God's divine intervention. And so what Mark is saying is, in some situations, like Philip going to the Ethiopian eunuch, can be for a moment to explain from the book of Isaiah, and then he's gone. And others, it's a one-time meeting. It's a series of meetings. And it builds all the way, can build, to that intensification of a group over a long period of time.